So as we continue on this second part of today's CEU seminar on components of culturally sensitive counseling, I wanted to review a little bit about what we've learned about multicultural counseling. We talked again about culture being the way a group of people do anything, whether that's hobbies, interests, their orientation to life, the community, who they define as family. But there are some challenges that we face when we're talking about being multiculturally competent. We may face issues with language barriers, and we need to have an option for interpreters when need be. We need to have an option if someone needs sign language or other accommodations. We also have the concern about premature dropout rates and terminations. Keep in mind, if someone feels misunderstood, they may leave. They may feel like, gosh, this provider can't even help me. They're not going to be able to help me work through things. Then we have the issue of, how does it feel if I have a different worldview from the client or different values? And as I said earlier, counseling is not culture or value free. Oftentimes, whether we see it directly or not, our clients can pick up on where we're coming from or what we believe. Now, of course, our role is not to force our views on a client, but it's important to broach and acknowledge if there are differences, but to relate to the client in terms of where they're coming from. Another challenge with multicultural counseling might be the historical differences in our life narrative. For example, someone like myself who's living here in Columbus, Ohio, who's never lived near a coastline, can't possibly understand experientially what it's like to live through something like a hurricane or the devastation associated with that. That would make a big difference in someone's historical narrative. Me, as a Caucasian middle-aged adult, can't understand what it would be like for someone to make prejudicial remarks about my race or ethnicity. So there's certain types of differences that I might not have experienced. That's why it's so important to hear the client's cultural narrative. One of the other challenges with multicultural counseling is that a lot of times our research is more based on self-report and opinion. We really still need to hone in more on objective, concrete measures. As I stated earlier in the first session of today's seminar, I mentioned that there's little emphasis on within group differences. And the fact of the matter is, we really want to tailor our treatment goals and approaches to each individual. There's also a false impression that multicultural counseling occurs strictly within certain racial and ethnic boundaries. Early on, say a decade ago, multicultural was synonymous with racial or ethnic-based issues. We didn't used to look at all the different dimensions of what constitutes personhood. Another problem or challenge with multicultural counseling is that oftentimes it excludes whites because it implies that culture doesn't count for them. Now, I'd like to dive into a role that the literature talks about being important for counselors, and that is called social justice. Before we dive into how we do this, I want to make sure we're all on the same page about what the definition of social justice is. Social justice is defined as a scholarship and professional action designed to change societal values, structures, policies, and practices such that disadvantaged or marginalized groups gain increased access to tools to help self-determination. Towards this end, one of the roles that they suggest that people in the mental health community be doing is being advocates for people to take action to produce environmental change on behalf of clients. For example, if we're to say that clients can better themselves through education and through getting certain types of jobs, does everyone really have access to getting that education? And what can we do to make clients aware of the resources? For example, I remember years ago counseling a high school age student. No one in her family of origin had ever attended college, and she had certain hopes and dreams and aspirations for her life. She wanted to go to college to be able to meet those hopes and dreams. So she talked about, when does Ohio State start their next quarter or semester? When can she start classes? But not having had someone in her family go to college before, she actually was ignorant of the idea that there was a process for applying to a college first, for getting your ACT or SAT scores, for filling out the college application and paying, possibly having an interview. There's a whole process surrounding that. She didn't understand that and was not aware of that. So we talked about what she would need to get together, how she would talk with her college advisors and counselors there, how to get the information she needs. Because she saw the end vision about the career that she ultimately wants in life, but didn't see the steps and didn't have the information. Another way that we might help someone with social justice is connecting them to community supports. For example, I work in a private practice setting, and my scope doesn't necessarily include case management, but I can talk with a client who needs transportation services, who needs access to resources about how they might get them, and give them the information to equip them for that. So in a 2008 article by Crether, Riviera, and Nash, they talked about four critical principles of social justice. They talked about making sure that our clients have fair distribution of resources, rights, and responsibilities, that everyone in society has access to that. This is what they call equity. They also talked about making sure that our clients have the knowledge, power, and the services that help them to self-actualize. Excuse me. So they may have these goals, they may be future-oriented, but in order for them to achieve those, they need to know the steps to get there. A third critical principle is that of participation. This is defined as the right of every person in society to participate in or be consulted on decisions that affect their lives, as well as that affect others around them in the environment. And finally, the fourth critical principle of social justice is harmony, basically helping individuals make sacrifices, understanding that sometimes we're looking at the good of the group and of the community. So our goal as a counselor, a therapist, or a mental health worker is to empower people to be able to take steps towards getting the information they need on a topic, towards connecting with resources for that, towards overall increased individual control in their own life. This may constitute helping them develop new skills or reframing in terms of strengths that they have. What's interesting is that this goes even beyond our counseling office. We should be basically aware of what's happening in the community that we're doing our therapy in, what's happening among churches, schools, legislative bodies, what are the policies on things, what are the programs that are available out there, how could we possibly educate others on things or refer them to resources if we're not aware of them ourselves. Part of this might be learning and educating people on the history of different groups, the protective factors, as well as the oppressive factors. questioning even our colleagues when need be if we feel like they're not giving a fair rap to certain types of groups. We also should be promoting culturally relevant interventions and interactions. We need to take into consideration not just the westernized medical views that we've all been taught, but also, for some people, what they're seeing as indigenous healing methods that may either complement the work we do or might be an alternative. We need to essentially be a community representative, an agent of change. Now, there's some critical questions towards this goal we may want to consider. Does client and counselor similarity or difference affect the outcome of counseling? As we stated in the first section, we're going to have different values. We're going to have different viewpoints from our clients. But there's a way we can still have cultural empathy, even if we don't agree on everything that our client has. We can allow their story to be their own story and then hear it and empathize and try and put ourselves in their shoes. We want to also look at, with multicultural counseling, what are effective counseling processes with a given group? The roles of various factors like age, gender, religion, the different tools that might be best. So the idea is not to sweep multicultural issues under the rug, but to invite the client to elicit discussion about these issues. So we're going to look at five different styles, per se, of approaching or not approaching multicultural issues. And as I go through them, the first ones that I go through are going to be the least admirable ones, and then moving towards a style that really embraces broaching all of someone's culture and incorporating that in the sessions as would be useful for the client. The first style is just avoidant. That person just groups everybody in the same group. We're all the same. There's no differences. There's no individuality. All races are the same. All people with certain demographics are the same. We really don't individualize treatment to each person. And this really does a disservice for people because the treatment goals are not individualized enough to what that client needs. Another style is isolating, basically being overly simplistic. While we might barely approach an issue, it's really approached just at a surface level. It's really not dealt with or anywhere near broached the way that we should. The third style is continuing congruent. This means that we actively invite a client to explore issues such as race, gender, and other cultural issues. It looks at the culture at large that the client's in, as well as the individualistic factors. So you see a movement as we go through each of these styles more towards an openness of what would be more multiculturally competent. The fourth style is integrated or congruent. We're not just inviting a client to bring up topics, but we're actually integrating them into what we do in our therapy. And I've had so many clients who've said, you know, that is refreshing because you've actually asked me the question, is this part of my life important? To what extent is it important? I remember I had a young Indian lady who lived with a number of her extended family in the same home. And she initially called me just wanting therapy for depression-related symptoms and the fact that she was single and having a difficult time meeting an eligible person that she could possibly settle down with. During her first session, she brought up all the opinions of the different relatives and what they suggested that she do. She verbalized a great deal of stress over all those opinions. So I asked her directly I said, you know, when you first called me, we talked a little bit about the depressive symptoms that you wanted to make sure and work on. But now I hear you also bringing in some factors about your culture and the opinion of those you live with. To what degree do we want to also address this in our goals? And she was thrilled that I brought that up. She said, you know, I think people assume because I'm from India, because I look Indian, because I live with a bunch of my Indian relatives in the home that I'm in, that that has to be one of the main things. It is an influence, and I don't want to not talk about it, but I also want to talk about who I am in a broader context as a person. So by broaching that, it really gave that perception of, teach me who you are. What's important to you? What's not important? Actually, you can also use scaling, like 1 to 10 scaling, to help someone pinpoint how much or how little a topic is important to them. And then finally, the last style is infusing. A consistent commitment to bringing up and broaching multicultural issues and social justice issues. The key with all of this is to remember what makes a difference to our clients. Counselors are perceived as more credible by clients when they bring up multicultural concerns directly. If we don't broach multicultural issues, we might err on the side of believing issues are colorblind. We might believe everyone's equal. We might have this wrong mentality of, oh, let people just pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Why don't they just kind of get it together and stuff, which they probably experienced already by people in their life and which might be part of the reason that they ended up in our office in the first place. We might assume that there's no within group differences, or we might just act based on limited experience. What broaching these topics does is it prevents misdiagnosis. It helps our clients to learn to trust us. It keeps them from prematurely terminating because they don't feel like we really understand them. It builds the therapeutic alliance because it gives the idea that we're more emotionally present. We're genuine. We're giving the idea that we want to hear their story. And we're more connected to them. When we look at culture, we can look at what the literature calls the status of counselors. This goes back to those 5 different areas we talked about a little bit ago. So those that whose status is disintegrated, they may have conflict. Because they might say they accept everyone, they try to understand their clients and individualize to the clients. But then when you look at the way they behave, maybe how they're talking to other counselors, maybe the way they respond to certain things their clients do or say, you can actually see that they do have biases that are unfair against certain types of clients or certain cultural issues. Another status the literature talks about is reintegrating. So there's this approach avoidance conflict where to some degree and with some issues, counselors may be okay broaching those, but then there may be other issues where they're like, I don't know. I'm kind of hesitant about even approaching it at all. And that gives a mixed message. If there's areas where a counselor feels uncomfortable approaching, those are the types of things where successful multicultural supervision should address them. We also have a status called pseudo-independence, where a conscious effort is made to interact with people from different cultures, but it's more just intellectual. This wouldn't be what I'd consider real broaching, real trying to understand someone else. That happens when we're talking about immersion. Really trying to understand and possibly even have some experiential situations with someone in a certain culture. then autonomy would be the top status of cultures, or of counselors, where they accept who they are individually and what they believe, where they're at in terms of culture, but also take seriously the role of social justice. Let's look at some examples about deciding how to broach certain topics. I appreciate you wanting to help me, but when I discharge from the program, I'm back on the same streets. I can have all the goals in the world, but what good is that if I'm still in the same neighborhood with gunshots, crime, and drugs? How am I supposed to stay sober with what's around me every day? So I may not have grown up, for example, as a counselor in a neighborhood with gunshots, crime, and drugs. But I can still try and relate via cultural empathy to this person of the terror of, okay, I'm safe here in the counseling office or in this program, but what happens when I'm out there? How do I maintain these goals? That's a very realistic question. If there are support systems, if there are resources, if there are community-based programs or things they could have access to, that would be useful for us to look into and possibly refer them to. If sobriety, for example, with this person is a challenge, how can they meet that moment to moment? The triggers may be really excessive around them. And instead of saying, oh, well, just decide this, just kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps, just have enough willpower, we need to be realistic in terms of broaching the idea of, gosh, you've tried to do this, but there's a lot of forces around you that seem to counteract that and seem to push against it. Let's look at a next example about broaching topics. You probably can't even have an idea what I've gone through. I'm sure your parents paid your way for a good opportunity in life. You never had to break new ground to leave the poverty, danger, lack of opportunities, and make a new path. You probably had your life taken care of since the time you were born. Your school, job, finances, and opportunities. I'm not sure you can even counsel me. Everything's been one struggle after another for me. And what I've done on my own. My first thought would be to affirm the openness and the vulnerability that this client has to be able to say that they're not sure. When we talk about building a therapeutic foundation, one of the questions that almost every client has is, how can you relate to me? What's going to be different? What can you offer me? We have to be careful not to dive into the position of trying to defend ourselves about whether or not our family has given us opportunities or compare ourselves. We really want to dive into the client's narrative. The fact that they've had to break new ground to try and leave all these oppression things, that's a significant part of their historical narrative. What I would tend to do is even to allow them in the session to share their dreams about what they think a counselor would need to be or what behaviors they would need to evidence to really be legitimate to be able to counsel them. Do they need to have gone through the same things? And at some point, it may be useful to say, you know, I may not have gone through those exact same things, but I can understand the pain and the terror of not knowing from moment to moment how you're going to get through these things. Also, it sounds like that client really prides himself or herself on the idea of self-preservation. When they say that they've done things on their own, that's something that you could capitalize on in terms of strengths-based therapy. Looking at, even though they're tired and worn out and have gone through a lot, what have they done on their own? How can they keep doing that, but building some support systems to walk alongside them? Let's look at another topic here. We have someone coming in saying, "You didn't say anything about my hair and piercings. I'm sure you noticed. I bet you don't sit that far away with other clients. What do you think? I'll get you?" And I find that clients really do want us to be genuine with them. Sometimes we need to let our clients know that we're really trying to understand the totality of who they are. That maybe one of the reasons we didn't say anything is because we didn't want to make that the main focus. One of the things is, we want to make sure not to assume something is an issue if it may not be for the clients, and to allow them the freedom to bring it up or broach it if need be. I actually had a preteen that came in that had colored his hair green, had some piercings and things. I didn't make a comment about it. And as he was leaving a few sessions later, he's like, "Oh, you didn't say anything." And so we talked about, did he want me to say anything? And what type of things was he looking for? And it was interesting, because I didn't place a huge emphasis on it, he ended up just like, "Oh, what's the big deal? Why did I do all this stuff anyway? Huh?" And then he ended up, after about 3 weeks, coloring his hair back to its original natural color. So part of it is seeing what's an issue or not an issue for a client. Keep in mind they're testing us out too to see how we're going to react. Let's look at the next scenario here. "My family all thinks I'm stupid for coming to you. They keep telling me I'll regret going out there to tell our business instead of keeping it among those who are right in the middle of things. I don't know if I'm doing the right thing coming here, but I feel like I need to sort through things by myself at this point." So there's that tension. And we don't want to answer with a direct comment like, "Yeah, you're doing the right thing, forget your family's point of view." We want to explore with them that tension that they're feeling. There's that, I want to be loyal to my family. They think things need to be solved one way, but I also feel like I need a different kind of support that maybe you and the counseling can offer. I would use the client's own words. "I feel I need to sort through things at this point," and try and sincerely hear what that means for them and what the type of support they get from their family, how that fits in or doesn't fit in with the sorting through that they're hoping to do versus what they're hoping the sorting through in counseling would look like. Let's look at this last scenario about deciding how, when, and if to broach topics. "I never get a chance. You know how it is. All those white execs expressing how the low-level factory worker is. Huh. How do they say slavery is gone when all the executives are white and the rest of us entry-level folks are just here? I'm sure you've seen it too. How many black professional counselors have you even met that are like you?" So, hearing the historical narrative is important. Maybe this person, first of all, they definitely sound like they're feeling misunderstood by the executives who can't relate to them. It also sounds like there's certain types of things they would like to be able to do on their job, or things they feel that they're capable of doing but may not be noticed. I'd be interested in looking at what those concrete behaviors are. What are the things they feel like they're being overlooked about? What are the opinions? What is the input that they may be able to offer? And how have they tried to share that with others? Or have they just assumed that people don't want to hear it? I remember one gentleman, we actually did some role plays in session about how would he approach someone. He was so convinced that if he tried to approach, they wouldn't even want to hear it, that he didn't even try. That he had this whole scenario built up in his head that they would never listen to him, even though he had worked at the company for many years. Now, keep in mind that our traditional therapeutic goals usually are more westernized goals. We tend to emphasize on things like individuality, youth, independence, nonconformity, being assertive. We tend to think that change is good, that sharing of all our feelings openly is good. We tend to emphasize on the uniqueness of each person. There are people, though, who may have a different worldview. What I'm listing here is a more Eastern worldview, for lack of a better way of saying that. It's not necessarily wrong or bad to have alternative treatment goals if they fit the situation with the client. Things like the building of relationship, things like building a sense of community, cooperation or conformity, things like controlling one's feelings for the common good, things like having collective goals, things like emphasizing traditionalism and conservatism. We need to look at what is best for a given client. Excuse me. I did want to mention briefly that when we talk about child counseling, that there's little or no research on child counseling on cultural identity. Very quickly, I did include in these slides some things about age and generational factors. And the fact is, those may make a difference in some situations. Look at if you're working with someone who was born in the earlier 1900s or has been through World War I or the Great Depression. What are the things that oftentimes they try to emphasize? They emphasize a lot of times loyalty and patriotism, working hard while you can, build a legacy, having an internal reward system. And even the baby boomers, who would be the kids of those people, tend to value hard work, work hard, save, build for the future, be faithful, start at the bottom up if you need be. And then we see some shifts overall happening with Generation X and the millennials. Some things about, well, things are all changeable, that they can be reevaluated. There's less likelihood of staying on a job long term. It's more entitlement, more individuality, each person just defining what's meaningful to him or her. Also, look at each of these profiles of the different age and generational things that I put on the slides. Imagine what it's like to live a life where there was no TV or even just black and white TV with very limited channels versus now all kinds of channels with a whole variety of different types of programming, plus access to the internet and games, video chats, and all kinds of things. Just on the dimension of technology alone, there's a lot of differences. So in terms of age and generational factors, that can really, really impact the work we do with clients. Again, we don't want to automatically assume because someone's a certain age that that age or generational factors are the most important to them. But we need to ask them, we need to broach whether or not that is a concern. Because I found for a significant number of individuals, it is a pretty central concern to some degree. Let's look at some examples so we can do some case conceptualizations about this idea of considering age and generational factors. This first one is about an older, middle-aged gentleman who's facing job loss. After 34 years with one company, I get let go. The new younger generation's coming in with their technology, their know-how, and their bright new ideas. Guess that means the old tried and true pillars of the company, like me, are out. And I've only gotten good reports. How am I to start it again on a new job? When I went into this company, devoting my all, and expected to retire with this company. So here we hear some very specific values. Things like you stick with something, you do your best work, you persist, you're loyal, you're devoted. He uses a phrase, tried and true pillar. That's talking about consistency and dedication and devotion to the company. He's making a comparison and contrast here with the younger people with their bright new ideas. And is this a legitimate question? How am I to make these adaptations? I'm wondering if this older middle-aged gentleman may feel threatened, like, gosh, I have something to offer here. Do they know what I have to offer? Are they really seeing what I've provided? Or are they seeing these new younger people as, quote, better or newer, able to offer certain things I can't offer? So one of the things we might want to do is support him in getting accurate information about what the company's thinking. He sounds like he's making some assumptions that they're saying, yeah, let's bring in these young people. And that may or may not even be correct. There may be some people in management who might say, you know, shoot, you've had a great track record. There's stability. There's things you can teach. There's ways that you approach things that really can be helpful even to these newer young people. There could be strengths from both groups. But nonetheless, it feels very threatening to him. We may need to support him in terms of broaching the topic with the management of the company about, are there any expectations that he learn some new technology, that he face some issues that are going to maybe be new for him or different for him. Let's look at this next example. A 20-year-old facing multiple life changes. I don't know why my parents act so worried. So I've gone through 5 jobs so far this year, and some changes in relationships and living arrangements. At least I have enough self-respect to not stick with something that's not working for me. I'm still trying to find out what I want, but they act like I should just cope with stresses and not rock the boat too much and make things work. Everything's modifiable. You keep looking till you find what works for you. Why stick with things that make you unhappy? I get to see somebody smiling and laughing, and fact of the matter is, we probably heard examples of this when we've worked with younger people, where many of them tend to think that, yes, things are modifiable. Yeah, the world's not over if I have to start again, and I'm going to do what's best for me. Now, there may be some strengths in that, but this is something to talk through in terms of helping this person maybe hear or see their parents' perspective about sticking through something even when it's uncomfortable. but also seeing some strengths in their perspective as well. Let's look at the next example here. A 35-year-old family man with health issues. I always thought I'd be around for my kids and spouse. I've eaten healthy, exercised, and basically taken care of myself. But now I'm only 35, and I'm facing a cancer diagnosis. The doctors are telling me that I should not expect to be the reliable pillar of strength I've been for all of us at home. They're saying I need some rest to allow myself to be taken care of. But how do you tell that to a wife and kids who need me? Very legitimate questions. There's a lot of grief work we probably have to do with this person. They probably thought at age 35 there were some issues they wouldn't be dealing with. Now all of a sudden the shock of dealing with or being forced to deal with some things that they never considered would be going on. They're feeling less strong, so we might need to work through some cognitive behavioral types of thoughts about how strength is defined. And it might even be good to bring in the family for some family sessions about things. Let's look at this next one. How can I go on? This is my boyfriend from high school to now. I never thought he'd betray me. I don't see any other way but just not living. I always thought he knew what we had, but I guess not. When I thought of our future, I always thought of the two of us together. I never imagined life apart. Everything's just awful. I can't do this alone. Maybe he'll appreciate what he had when I'm not here anymore. So this girl is definitely feeling depressed. She may feel suicidal. We really need to assess safety risks, of course. Someone might say, oh, well, yeah, it was just a first love. It was someone you met in high school and what you're used to. Explore your options. Just do A, B, and C. But fact of the matter is for her, even though she is young, she had the mindset that she'd always be with this person. And that's a mindset that maybe needs to be explored. Let's look at the next example here. An elderly lady who feels alone. My family never comes around. You're the first visitor besides nurses and staff here. It's like I raised them and they got what they wanted out of me. And now they have no use to come around anymore. Took care of every single one of them with all I could give. And now when I need someone, there's no one around. Seems like they're just counting down the days till I die. So we're talking about an elderly person and their expectations that if I gave of my time and my energy, that my kids and people would be there for me. And then finding out that that's not actually happening. Finding out that the support systems aren't there. So besides the grief from that, it's important to look at what are we going to do from here in terms of connecting her to support systems. So when we're looking at culture meetings, we need to be aware of our own culture in our meetings. Know the culture meanings of those around us. Know things like, how do you greet someone? Is it a handshake? Is it just a head nod? What about eye contact? Some groups, those mean certain things, while others, they may mean something else. So it's important to see what you can find out about the group that you're going to be working with. Now, in terms of multicultural therapy, we're looking at some key elements the willingness to change, willingness to experience anxiety and to learn, self-awareness, willingness to confront problems, a will to change. So most of our clients come in not knowing how they want things to change, but they just want things to be different from what they are. If they have a will to change, that's something where we can either work on skill development or helping maintain skills. Then we look at hope for change. How do we instill hope? And social supports. One of the things the literature repeatedly says is that if someone wants to change, but they feel like they don't have the backing or the social support to do so, that's one of the most critical factors for people. When we're putting multicultural issues in context and working with clients, we're talking about who they define as family, what they believe about sickness and health, relationships between individuals and family, how generations relate, ideas about expression or lack of expression, nonverbal protocols. We want to be culturally sensitive. There's literature out there that actually talks about the definition of culturally sensitive treatment. And in that literature, they talk about the difference between what's empirically supported and what might be best for a given client. So we're looking at what clients say meets their needs. I remember with one of my clients from an Eastern worldview, one of my past interns said, well, why isn't assertiveness a goal with her? Why don't we just help her to kind of tell her family off in a nice way and set boundaries with them? And so we ended up talking about how this is not where the client's coming from. So her point of view is, how do I respect the family and extended family point of view and all the opinions they're going to give, but still try and present my point of view about things? How do I have conformity to some degree? How do I focus on, quote, the common good of the whole family system, the larger family? So we're looking at incorporating the client's values, matching their values, incorporating their culture into the work we do. This might involve cultural sensitivity training for our staff. It involves knowledge of referrals to outside sources. So there's a lot of things we have to be aware of what's out there. There's things called cognitive match models in terms of working with clients in a multiculturally competent way. With a cognitive match model, we're trying to define the problem in a way that the client would see it. We're incorporating their worldview in terms of the goals. We're looking at developing skills in areas where they lack. We're looking at incorporating their worldview, family supports, collateral supports, community supports. This may require getting releases of consent for some of those outside people. Another model that also would be culturally sensitive would be a racism acknowledgement model. There's a number of people that may feel like their opportunities are limited because they're misunderstood by certain other people. And so we may need to look at, how do we instill optimism in them? How do we do the social justice thing? How do we raise consciousness about these issues that they're battling? Another type of culturally sensitive treatment involves acculturation models, helping sort through the needs of family and community versus individuality. Looking at the double bind messages between being caught possibly in their culture or country of origin versus being here in the U.S. And then we also have models that are spirituality or religious-based models that may look more on education, expressing feelings or regulating, relaxation, developing a sense of community. So we have these three different things weighing on a client at a given time. We have the whole group that they're in, the sense of culture, who they identify with. So the group, that might be their community, their family, the people who think and believe and have values like them. Then we also have the individual aspects of that client, regardless of the groups they're in, the things that are unique to who they are. And then we have a third piece weighing on it at the same time, which is the universal. There's some aspects that many people relate to. So when we look at a cultural accommodation model, such as that Long provides, he suggests that every person is simultaneously these three different aspects. He or she is like all other people, so that universal aspect, like some other people, meaning part of certain groups, and individually, like no other people. So that's where we're trying to navigate when we're talking about being multiculturally competent. Some of the issues and some of the techniques that are used with different cultural groups are things I'm going to present next here. These are things that are all in the literature, that are noted to be effective, either concepts that should be addressed with different people or types of techniques that have been supported by the empirical literature. One of the issues, when we talked about historical narrative, is dealing with clients with their perceptions of discrimination. So we're talking about what the literature calls perceived racism. Again, this is a subjective experience of racism and prejudice based on their life experience. Certain groups have felt more of this. Black people, women, people in lower socioeconomic groups have tended to be those in the literature that have verbalized this perceived racism or perceived oppression historically. And so it's important, if this is part of the client's narrative, to be able to hear that. How do we confront it? One of the things that they debated was, okay, what if we allow ourselves to be around people of different groups? Would that help us to just confront racism? Is just having an increasing frequency of contact enough? The literature has found that no, that's not enough. It's not just the frequency of familiarity with new groups. The critical elements, if we're going to address issues of perceived racism, is to have a willingness to re-examine worldviews and life experiences. Second, a development of a higher proportion of neutral or positive interactions with that group. So, for example, a lot of times, just interacting with someone doesn't mean that we're going to like them more or like the group they're in. We actually have to have some successful, positive, or even neutral experiences. And this works more with people of what they call equal status. So let's say here I am a master's plus post-grad educated counselor. It's best for me, and it works best when we're talking about people on a similar level, trying to relate to each other. Some of the things the literature suggests when you're counseling Black Americans or African Americans in general that are important, one is to know Black history. Hear what that is for the client. That's a significant influence. And I know some counselors like to brush it off and say, oh, come on, get over it, or think differently, or don't focus on this part of who you are. But we really do need to hear the client's narrative. Oftentimes we find that with Black or African Americans that there is a stronger religious and spirituality base. They may be more likely to go to the community or the church or talk more about spiritual practices as a viable option for treating or dealing with life stresses than necessarily coming to our office for counseling. The role of community is often a huge issue for people in this category. There's extensive literature about what is called the drama of opposition and the desire to make the conflict known about how they've been oppressed. So this is something that would be useful to hear if this is a concern for someone. Feeling heard, feeling like you matter just as much as the next person. I know I've said so many times so far today about the importance of hearing someone's historical narrative, but I can't overemphasize that for any group, for any person. When we're talking about culture in general, we really need to hear the totality of what makes up this person. In terms of what the literature says in dealing with Black Americans or African Americans in general, we're oftentimes looking at people with a greater range of motion, energy, and quick responses. So don't be surprised if someone's a little more energized. That doesn't necessarily mean, oh gosh, they're manic. They're too hyper. That may just be them. So we want to really put that in context. There may be challenges regarding premature termination because they may not feel that that narrative is listened to. There's issues about single parent families or lack of support systems that are oftentimes highlighted in the literature. The literature, though on the positive side, highlights that whether it's a biological parent or someone else, even if it's a peer mentor, that can make a huge difference in the life of African Americans growing up. So those are the type of things we want to emphasize. There is a professor whose last name is Elligan, who actually designed an empirically supported approach to work with kids, primarily Black or African American children, that incorporates rap music. He calls it rap therapy. This may sound interesting, but you know, a lot of times I find, especially when I'm talking to teenagers or young adults, that music and the music culture, whatever style of music that they listen to, really is significant. That maybe they won't sit and talk just like an adult will to you, but hey, if we play some music and talk about what songs they identify with and the stories in those songs, they can relate to that. So basically, we are looking at the statistics of 97% of those in many of the studies that identify as Black or African American said they liked rap music. Half of them bought one or more rap CDs a month. There's different styles of rap, but most of them tell some type of narrative or story. So what Elligan suggests is that you start out early on in the sessions during assessment time, finding out and building rapport with the client, what artists, what topics, what things do they tend to enjoy. Then build the therapeutic alliance through empathy and rapport building. Maybe listen with the client to some of the music. Discuss. Show an interest in that. Reframe the use of rap music. This isn't just a hobby or something, but it could be a strengths-based method. It could be an indirect metaphor for what they're going through. He talks about the key to making this rap therapy work is to see rap as poetry and narrative. Some story is being told about something. And While a client, again, may not directly just tell you what they're going through, they can, through music, through poetry, through art, through those different forms of media, sometimes identify better what their needs are. Then ultimately, his goal is to see if the clients might be able to write their own rap, to take some behavioral steps. Some of the things the literature talks about in general that help Black Americans is supportive counseling, information giving about different resources in the community, about things like underage pregnancies, about job opportunities, about stress management, social justice issues like the racism we talked about, and cognitive behavioral approaches. There's a lot of literature out there that talks about some of the belief systems that a subgroup of those who are Black or African Americans believe. Things like studying is a white thing. I might not be living so long in this neighborhood, so do I have to do all this stuff? Domestic violence or certain things may be part of the way of life. He or she made me hit him or her. There's no jobs for us out there anyway. So these are things in the 2009 article by Harper, Terry, and Twiggs that they highlight are some of the messages that some people struggle with that might be useful for us to talk with them about. It may be helpful behaviorally to incorporate resources, like I said, like music, videos, resources out there, and linkage to community supports. When we're talking about Asian clients, the literature has talked about the importance of collective goals. There tends to be an emphasis on values of respect, pride, and dignity. They like to work with a counselor or a therapist who they see as knowledgeable. It does make a difference to them, the decor in the office. Is it professional? Are there certificates on the wall? You know, what is showing that you're a professional and that you're competent? They may be more reserved in their interactions with you, and this may not necessarily be resistance. It may just be that they perceive that they're coming to, quote, an expert who can help them sort through some issues, and they really are just wanting some direct teaching about what to do from here. They do like some of their native healing types of approaches to be incorporated. I mean, keep in mind again that most of the world isn't necessarily as hyper-focused as we are on the medical approaches. They tend to value decorum and conformity. So be careful with trying to incorporate techniques about assertiveness and speak up and whatever when they may legitimately want techniques that help to look at what is the common good. How do we look at what is a good goal for the group? Whether it's Asians or Hispanic individuals, a lot of times filial therapy or therapy that involves the community or the family is really useful. So you may really essentially be doing a big group. Cognitive behavioral therapy really is something that the Asian population really likes because it's very practical. You can go through step by step. Teach, here's the thought errors, here's the behaviors you do different. They like something concrete like that. The literature talks about Native American clients that a lot of times they just need time to sit with you, to focus on being in the moment. Direct eye contact, which we tend to think is important in this culture, may not be important in every culture. In some cultures, keep in mind that it may be seen as disrespectful, especially if you're looking directly in the eye of an elder, because it's, I know some cultures, they talk about looking down or looking away when you're talking to someone who's older than you. Now, the literature also talks about working with Hispanic or Latino clients. In general, again, family and community is very important. One of the considerations is, do you counsel them in their native language or do you counsel them in English? And sometimes if you allow them to have a translator and to talk in their individual language, you may hear more emotion. You may actually hear a greater degree of expression coming out of them. They tend to have values of respect for authority figures, the importance of the role of family, and the importance of respect for a professional. One other group that's important for us to consider being in the location that we're in is dealing with Appalachian clients. Their history, the landscape, poetry, the folklore, the crafts are important to them. They may have a lot of poverty and deprivation, but on the other hand, through the historical narratives that have felt oppressed and where there's been oppression, there also has been a sense of real strength of pulling together and looking at, well, what are we going to do from here? A lot of times they're pulled together with multiple generations just to stay on their land, just to hold things together. So narrative therapy can be really important for them because they identify with each other. Now, therapy in general oftentimes is a more Western idea, but lately, I would say in the last 5 to 10 years, the idea of counseling, especially family therapy, has gained in some countries. They found that in China, that just in the 1980s, they started offering family therapy courses for graduate students. Their family therapy there that has been successful to some degree has focused on how do you defer to the common good, on fulfilling family obligations, on duties, on the collective good. Parent-child relationships are emphasized even over spousal relationships. So these are important things to notice if you have someone who maybe came from a certain culture, or if you ever get an opportunity to go to another culture and do some type of work. In India, there's a lot of regulation with marriage. There's increasing rates of suicide among young people. So that is an issue. There's a lot of issues regarding HIV, issues about women staying home and caring for men with HIV, but men leaving the women with HIV. In Israel, family therapy actually was founded over there in the 1960s, so family therapy is very, very highly regarded. But there tends to be some divisiveness between Israeli and Palestinian family therapists. So they tend to want someone who is, quote, like them. There's influence of war, influence of different divisions politically there, trauma issues related to war and related to what's going on are very significant to them. In Peru, family therapy holds an interesting interpretation. The concern that people have in Peru is that they believe that if you're doing family therapy, it must mean someone's mentally ill. And mental illness is extremely frowned upon there. They look at all problems as family problems, that if they can just discuss them through the family, then they can solve them. In terms of the country Turkey, they have national family therapy centers in connection with courts. But in Turkey, they're very specific about calling it family counseling, not family therapy. So the language that's used is very important. In the country Uganda, we're talking about rural people who use the term family counseling for more guidance about how to live day-to-day life. That could be guidance in the schools, guidance regarding health education, guidance about day-to-day practices. It could be information about issues like HIV and AIDS. And the influence of spirituality is very key with people in that culture. So how do we stay multicultural and competent with that, but also be evidence-based? So there's this debate out there about, is it better to use evidence-based general practices or specific culturally relevant practices? In terms of those who believe the general practices are better, they say that patients with similar psychiatric conditions tend to benefit from similar therapies. They focus on the common qualities that people have with similar psychiatric issues, and they minimize the uniqueness of people. Those who say that we really need to come up with some more distinct culturally relevant types of therapies talk about the unique needs of specific groups. For example, Puerto Ricans deal better with interpersonal therapies than something like CBT. Empathy and therapy need to be modified in terms of their definition and what that means to each individual. We don't want to overemphasize differences, nor do we want to overemphasize similarities. So we really need to look at each case at where the client's at. Mindfulness is another concept that you've probably heard more about in the literature lately. And this can also bridge the gap in terms of culture, because we're talking about the here and now experience of a given client. There's 5 different areas that mindfulness may include. Things like observing their thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Second, it may include just acting with awareness, so intentional decisions. Third, describing inner experiences. Fourth, remaining non-judging of inner experiences. 5, remaining non-reactive to inner experiences. So, as we're looking at this, mindfulness can be helpful in any culture just in terms of increasing awareness. Those are factors that we can broach and we can work through. With the changing face of America, it's important for us to also know what the policies are, what the updated information is regarding immigrants. If social justice is a key issue for us, we need to make sure there's equal access to resources, rights, and treatment for everyone. Keep in mind that immigrants tend to face issues regarding trauma, possibly from the cultures they're coming from. We may hear narratives about post-traumatic stress, war-related violence, threats of personal injury, torture, assault, malnutrition, famine, and disease. There's stress in the immigration process, the papers that have to be filled out, the process, the language barriers, the interviews, just the hoops that have to be jumped through. So there's a lot of things that may need to be processed with someone. I've done quite a bit of work since my ex, my girl's dad, actually is from another country with people with these different immigration issues or different cultural issues. And there is a lingering stress about all those steps, about the weight, about some family taking time to get over here, about the amount of money it costs, about cultural differences, differences about just how things are done. Remember, the definition of culture is how a group of people does something. Schools are different from one place to another. Peer relationships. You might have someone come from a culture where, again, community is emphasized, and then they come to an individual culture like this one, and they feel lost. They feel like it's incredibly difficult to try and make friends. Housing concerns can be issues. Differences in values. One of the big issues with someone with immigration issues is identifying, who am I? And it can be awfully confusing for them. Who am I now? I thought I knew who I was pretty solidly when I was in my home country, and then I came here, and now I'm not allowed, or it's not reinforced, to do A, B, and C this way here. So I have to decide if I'm going to feel like an outcast and take pride in the things that were important to me in my country of origin, or if I change. And then to what degree do I change, and what does that look like? There's financial struggles. The education system being different in different cultures, it may be hard for certain people to find a job because their education system may not mean the same thing as ours does here. Other issues that immigrants may face are things like self-esteem issues, hopelessness, depression, guilt, discrimination. They feel isolated. There may be difference of opinion and even practices about what constitutes family, about extended family, who lives in the home, how marriage is approached, and parenting methods. Sometimes immigrants may feel judged for allowing their kids to roam more freely than we usually do here. They may not know how to approach some of the concerns here about crime, about child abuse, about certain issues in our society. Oftentimes, when you have people coming from other cultures, they may come from a culture where the elderly are respected, where anyone who's considered older, whether it's a middle-aged adult or an elderly person, is given more respect than the younger child. And when they come here, then a lot of times immigrants will feel this internal struggle about how in the world, you know, do I deal with seeing people just emphasize youth, emphasize certain other things other than respect for the elderly or respect for elders. There's definitely differences of opinion and approach in terms of what constitutes discipline for kids and what's okay. There's things here that would be considered abuse that in other cultures may not be. I remember talking with a family attorney recently who said that in the country that her client's family was from, the dad believed that in trying to drown the kids, he was getting rid of evil spirits in them. And that was consistent with their culture. I know some cultures using certain objects on the skin of a kid maybe something that's practiced or is okay, but may be considered abusive here. The immigrants also may struggle with just pessimism. On the one hand, we might be saying, wow, look at all the opportunities that you have now that you're here. But look at all the grief and the losses and changes they're having to deal with. Along with the issue of immigrants, we have a population called trans cultures, these third culture kids. Kids who are born in one culture and grew up in another, they really struggle with this idea of who I am. There's this conflicted sense of self and multi-generational conflicts of, okay, how do I listen to my parents and elders, but then my teachers here and people in this society might have different beliefs. So we're seeing an increasing amount of kids that are not just biracial, but multiracial, that have multiple identities. This is becoming more and more almost the norm. So a lot of times you're going through intensely emotional experiences. What do we do with these kids? How do we approach this with them? Well, it's important to listen to their narrative as well. Listen to their definition. Listen to how they're trying to deal with their multiple heritage backgrounds. What's particularly difficult is during certain ages, like when they're teenagers and they're trying to navigate who they are anyway, developmentally, and then on top of that they have cultural issues, those challenges can become worse at those times. So one of the things that's very helpful to a number of these kids is using bibliotherapy or using storytelling. You want to find narratives that are restorative, narratives that look at the issues they're going through, but proactively solve those issues. Look at journaling, role plays, group work. That might help them to not feel alone. We also see an increase in biracial couples. Just the number is going up. We really want to make sure with all these changes in the nature of who's around us that as we meet with clients, we decentralize race or ethnicity as being the only issue. That we want to take them into what their overall narrative is. We want to look at what their hot button topics are. We want to look at what they think is most important. To this end, a lot of times people will have different approaches than what we're used to in this Western medical model about what is wellness versus disease. You know, we're taught to such an extreme to focus on the medical model. But the question I pose is, does this really fit in with multicultural competency? We have other cultures that are focusing on things like spirituality, that are more holistic. They're looking at multiple definitions of what causes disease. So it's not just medicine that's a solution, but there may be prayer, there may be rituals, there may be diet or food, there may be changes in behaviors that they believe either contribute to the problems or actually help the solutions. So we look at how we can become more flexible in terms of dealing with these clients, how we can be more aware of resources and the sense of community. One of the real challenges is if you've ever looked in the DSM in the back about the culture-bound syndromes. You know, sometimes there's a way, especially in terms of physically feeling things like anxiety, how other cultures express that compared to what we have been trained. So it's important. And if you have a chance, really familiarize yourself with these things. That sometimes people come in and we might make the error of thinking it's just super somatic and they need to calm down and chill out and not be so somatic. But actually, it could be something that's more synonymous with one of those culture-bound syndromes. There's a resistance overall in many other non-Western cultures and even using the term mental health or depression. Because oftentimes it's seen as something for quote-unquote insane people. So it's not something about the concept of wellness and bettering yourself. It's seen as problem people or institutionalized people. They're more likely in many other settings to consult native healers. This might be a shaman, a guru, even an exorcist. And keep in mind, you know, they're not necessarily being resistant. It's just consistent with their worldview. Extended family, native healers, and community oftentimes are much more highlighted than clinical counselors and mental health professionals. A lot of cultures still don't have a concept of what's called family therapy. So while that may be something that we've been taught and we're used to, not everybody agrees or believes with it. So what we're doing is we're helping understand from their point of view what is distressing them. They might say it's their feelings or emotions. For many people from other cultures, they're going to come in because of somatic symptoms. They may also say it's bad luck or curses from people watching them, tracking them, or, from fables that they have in their culture. And we have to place this in the context of their culture. We need to really consider their different views. Are there other things that might be alternatives to counseling or used in connection with counseling? What constitutes professional help to them? There's a whole lot of people out there in the world who believe in things like acupuncture, bioenergy, the evil eye, herbals, healers, homeopath, hypnosis, meditation, miracle healings, prayer, deliverance, priests, voodoo, vitamins, shamans. There's a lot of people that believe in these other things. Now, personally, you may or may not agree with those, or your worldview may not include those things, but it's very important, like I said, to hear the narrative of the client and where they're coming from with that. Spirituality is a big issue and reason that a lot of people from other cultures give for why they may have a certain issue. That's why, even in the assessment portion, it's important to find out what someone's views are concerning religion and spirituality, how they believe that may or may not affect counseling, how they got to this point in their narrative, what was their spiritual journey, why are they at where they're at today versus where they had been before. What does it mean to be holistic? The literature talks about, in particular, people who are conservative Christians having some pretty strong expectations about what therapy should include. They would like therapy, in addition to the regular clinical evidence-based techniques, to consider including things like moral teachings, scriptures, Bible verses, prayer in session, stories about people's narrative experiences of how they learn things, of getting to this point. They also want the therapist to be open to consulting with religious leaders, priests, pastors, or, quote, spiritual authorities. Of course, you want to make sure you have a release of consent to do this, but this could be a useful adjunct to therapy. Conservative Christians also want religious language used in counseling. They want to make sure that someone understands what they're going through and accepts them and how they approach things. Their hope is that the counseling process will oftentimes lead to a closer relationship with God, a better prayer life, or a lifestyle that's more consistent with their Christian views. Sometimes we found that it could be more challenging working with people that have certain conservative views because of some of the beliefs they have. They may find that focusing on self is selfish That might be one belief you have to break down. They might feel like there's only one certain way to God, and so that's another belief, or that there's only certain answers, or that pleasant feelings like joy and peace and happiness are the only feelings that should be wanted, desired, or manifest or talked about. And certain social issues may be frowned upon. So these are things you want to consider as you're working with people with different spiritual beliefs. There's actually some questions in terms of incorporating spirituality that you can use with a client. Things like, do you wish to discuss spiritual issues in counseling? Do you believe in God? And who is God to you? What does spirituality mean to you? I'll use like a 1 to 10 scaling. So if 10 is spirituality, it's critically important and something I include in all aspects of my day-to-day life. And then 1 might be, oh gosh, I don't even take spirituality to mean much in my life or don't emphasize it. That can really give you a useful tool. You also might want to know if they have religious affiliations or practices, if they really follow through on the teachings of their religion, what they do to understand or incorporate God's guidance. Anything they don't like about their spiritual practices and the extent to which they want that or don't want that incorporated into counseling. There's ways of incorporating religious or spirituality-based elements into counseling. For example, an alternative to CBT is rational Christian therapy. That looks at some of the common misbeliefs that people have and how to change it. Beliefs like, God must answer my prayers as I'd like to have them be answered. Bad people deserve bad things, good people deserve good things. If I worked hard enough, God will give me what I deserve. People should have mercy on me, but others should get justice. So rational Christian therapy will look at some of those beliefs and how to rework those. There's also solution-focused counseling for people with spiritual concerns. Looking at things like, was there a time you coped better? How did you manage? How did you draw on spirituality as a strength? So while my experience has mainly been with people in the Christian faith, there's also a lot of literature to show that people with other areas and other faiths may consider religion and spirituality a huge issue that may need to be incorporated to some degree in counseling. For example, there's a lot of literature increasing on counseling American Muslims. For them, the importance of practicing things like praying 5 times a day, fasting, giving to charity, or making a pilgrimage to Mecca are very important. Things about their abstinence from alcohol, about their dress, and about the role of extended family are also very important. They may have dealt with feeling isolated, misunderstood, hopeless, judged, or having trauma as well. So these are key things that we definitely want to talk about. What I'd like to do is wrap up here, and then we'll finish the last portion of today's seminar shortly. We'll talk about people with disabilities, some other different aspects like genograms, cultural heritage and counseling, and then we'll end up wrapping up with some examples, some case examples as well. So we'll come back in a little bit here, and then we'll finish up some other aspects on culture.